I noticed there's been no mention today of our sustainability report. I think one of the executives said after the meeting last year that after quite a degree of delay, many other companies around the world cooperating with the Carbon Disclosure Project, that we had decided to produce a sustainability report and we had decided to submit to the Carbon Disclosure Project. And I noticed that the sustainability report wasn't out the front with all the other reports. There's been no reference to the sustainability report today, and there's been no reference to our submission to the Carbon Disclosure Project. So I just asked perhaps John to give us an update on what we've done. And rather than talking in terms of carbon intensity, which is one way of measuring things, perhaps give us a few numbers on straight carbon emissions, because people do still say that we're the biggest power user in the country. I probably would have thought it would have been Rio, but give us an update on that. Are we the biggest power users in the country? And within the AWAC joint venture, exactly how much carbon are we pumping out around the world? And just take us through the experience within the Carbon Disclosure Project and the sustainability report. And my third question, I guess, goes to a more specific issue within that, which is the two smelters in Victoria. We heard about the terrific progress being made, certainly in WA. In Victoria, our two smelters, many people argue, are heavily subsidised in terms of the price we pay for power and are supplied by some of the dirtiest brown coal-fired stations in the world. There's been a number of discussions over many years about expanding Portland, putting in another pot line, and there's been talk about gas as an alternative fuel source, power source for that. Where are we at with the whole negotiations with the Victorian government, negotiations with potential gas suppliers, and the long-term future of those smelters? I think the power contracts expire in 2014 and 2016, respectively. It's been 5 years of debate, and we didn't really hear much today on where the whole situation is at. So I'd be interested to hear from you on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Main. I'll ask John to respond to your specific questions about the sustainability report and the smelters in a few minutes. However, I would refer you to his address, in which he gave quite a comprehensive set of comments on what AWAC has done and is doing with respect to greenhouse gases, and specifically referred to the two Victorian smelters in that. However, I'll ask John to add to it. With regard to alumina's cost, alumina owns 40% of a $20 billion enterprise. I believe that our shareholders should expect to have a board and management which will represent their interests in that $20 billion enterprise. The fact that we are not the manager or the majority holder, in fact, adds to the complexity and challenges of representing shareholders in that particular business. And as I indicated in my comments about saying that John is leaving, this really leads to a requirement for strong leadership and a persuasive approach to ensure that we always have our shareholders' views and rights represented in that joint venture. To do that, we clearly need very capable and competent people. And we're very pleased that we've had that with John and his team over the past few years. As far as the cost of administering it, we are a company that's listed in Australia. We're listed in the United States. That has obvious costs. We have substantial financing arrangements in place which have to be managed. But overall, the cost in 2007 of the administration of the company was $12.6 million. And I believe that, coming back to my first point, that this is representing our shareholders in a $20 billion enterprise, I think that shareholders could be expecting management to work actively and intelligently to express their views in that. And that can only be done by properly spending money and rewarding these people. But I would add that there is no suggestion within either the board or the management that they're not very cost conscious, and costs are always an issue which we are carefully managing. The other comment you made was about the CEO's package. In fact, the incoming CEO's package is identical to John Marley. I would now like to ask John if he would like to comment on the issue of sustainability report and also subsequently on the smelters in Victoria.
Thank you, Chairman. One of the reasons that I thought it was important to devote about a third of my speech on climate change and sustainability, as I outlined at the start of my presentation, it is one of the most significant issues facing energy-intensive industries and the aluminium industry worldwide, and also pointed to the fact that for 20 years now, we've been making significant progress. It is important to understand, if I can just step aside to give a context to, you know, what I think is a good question from Stephen in terms of understanding all the dimensions. The aluminium is a very important part of addressing climate change. We need to remember that, we need to be aware that transportation represents about 20% of man-made global greenhouse gas emissions. The use of aluminium and the increasing use of aluminium, and over the last 30 years, aluminium has componentry in motor vehicles has increased by 30%. Each kilogram of aluminium that replaces steel over the life of the vehicle saves in the order of about 150 to 200 kilograms of CO2 emissions. So aluminium is also part of the solution. So as we increasingly see the use of aluminium in lightweighting of transport, it has a direct impact in reducing CO2 emissions. Second point that I'll make that the chairman also alluded to is that this strong growth in aluminium, about 60% of the aluminium ever produced in the world over the last 100 years is still in use. And the primary reason for this is the benefits of recycling aluminium. And there are a number of benefits. Aluminium loses none of its properties in terms of strength, its electrical conductivity, its appearance, etc., in being remelted. There are very high levels of aluminium recycling. But the second go round, and we talked a little about this last year, only 5% of the energy on recycling is required compared with the first part, with when it was first produced in the smelting process. In terms of providing information, since 2003, for the last 5 years, on our website, we have provided sustainability information, and Alcoa of Australia also for much longer periods has provided complete disclosure in terms of the level of CO2 emissions from our various operations here in Australia, and since 2003 that's been provided across the world. So there's been no, if there's a suggestion that we've not provided that information, we've been required to disclose it. Alcoa of Australia was part of the, one of the founding partners of the Australian Industry Greenhouse Network. It's important that we've provided that information, and it's been available. Last year in 2007, across the AWAC system, total greenhouse emissions were in the order of about 16.5 million tonnes. About a little over half of that were emissions which came from power production for the smelters, and of the remaining eight in the refining sector, roughly half in Australia and the other half overseas. Alcoa, who operates the joint venture, have participated in the Carbon Disclosure Project worldwide since its inception, with very clear information available. We provided that as Alumina Limited as well from last year. We will again provide that again this year, and we have put our sustainability report on our website. I apologise, Stephen, if you felt that we should have also had copies available here at the AGM. In terms of power, as I said in my speech and addressed, I think, quite comprehensively, that the AWAC smelters in Australia are amongst the most efficient in the world. It's not accidental that the level of greenhouse gas emissions per each tonne of aluminium aluminium produced at our smelters has reduced since 1990 from about 5 tonnes to 2 tonnes. That's something we're extraordinarily proud of, and that's a measure of the intensity in improving emissions at our smelting process. I can also speak on behalf of the Australian aluminium industry, and I'm chairman of the Aluminium Council, that the performance at all of the other company smelters here in Australia has been of a similar level and amongst the best in the world. So those are steps that have actively been taken, that have actively been addressed over the last 20 years. Here in Victoria, most of Victoria's power, not all, but most of it, of course, is supplied from power stations in the Latrobe Valley, which use brown coal as its energy source. Brown coal, as I indicated, has higher relative emissions compared with, say, black coal or compared with natural gas or with, say, hydroelectric power. And that is a very substantial resource that Victoria has. The power generation capability in Victoria has been a very important part of the economic growth and the strength of the economy in this state. The emissions from those power stations will need to be addressed over the period of time. It's not an easy solution. It will require technology. We're aware of a number of the power generators evaluating options such as coal drying, other options to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I'm very confident they will all be part of that factor coming in. Equally, we will also evaluate, as I referred to in my speech, other sources of energy supply for the long term as well. We, like many other aluminium producers around the world, have competitive power contracts. That's important. The Point Henry and Portland smelters do have competitive power contracts, similar to many of other smelting operations around the world. Power contracts are in place until 2014 and until 2016. We have and we will continue the negotiations, or Alcoa of Australia will, to replace those contracts. We are confident that we can replace those contracts. As I said, these are very efficiently managed smelters. They are very cost competitive. They are well run, and they provide jobs for 2,000 employees in this state. A slightly long-winded answer, but I think it is important that we look at and understand all of those factors. I hope I've addressed all of the issues. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman. I'd like to start by quoting from the letter that the Alcoa, then Alcoa CEO, Alain Belder, sent to Hugh Morgan back in November 2001, when the whole takeover demerger issue was up and running. And just a brief quote from the then CEO of Alcoa. WMC only holds a 40% minority interest in AWAC, which is subject to Alcoa's virtual complete control, is subject to an absolute prohibition on transfers to a certain class of buyers, and is further subject to Alcoa's right of first refusal in the event of a proposed transfer to any buyer. On the subject of dividends, WMC has a vote if AWAC proposes to distribute less than 30% of annual net income, but not otherwise. Moreover, Alcoa's control and management rights will remain completely unaffected by your proposed demerger. Now, I guess the argument I've been raising for four of the last five AGMs before today is that we are a postbox company that doesn't do anything, that doesn't have control over anything in reality, yet we continue to present ourselves and be paid as if we're some sort of large, real, normal company with thousands of employees. John can't influence the aluminium price, and John can't influence Alcoa's running of AWAC, as that comment from Alain Belder says. So I remain perplexed as to why we continue to have a largish board paid full freight, the CEO on $1.5 million a year, a finance director on $850, the general counsel on $600. And my specific question to you is, why did we feel the need to replace John? I mean, we could have saved ourselves $1.5 million a year. We've got John Pizzi on the board. He's an old Alcoa guy. But things we've got to manage are basically, you know, financials and annual reports. So we need the company secretary. We need the finance guy. And then we need a couple of directors who've got a good relationship with Alcoa and can try and encourage them one day to make a bid. And John's that guy. So I fully support getting John on the board, but I just can't work out why we've had to hire another CEO and pay him $1.5 million a year to do not much. So why did you not consider saving us shareholders the money? I mean, it was costing $3.5 million in 2001 to run this show. Now it's costing $12.6 million. The share price has only gone up 21% from the first trade to now. We've underperformed in share price performance, and we're top-heavy in management, board, and your remuneration report copped a 42% against vote last year. You were sent a message on that. You've made a few changes, but I think it just all seems a bit peripheral. So why didn't you think we could get by without going for another full freight CEO costing us $1.5 million a year when we are, as you described back in 2003, a post-box company with a handful of employees who, as Alan Belder says, has no control over much at all?
Thank you, Mr. Main, for your comments. Just on a couple of facts, I certainly don't recall ever referring to Illumina as a postbox company. You specifically referred to, and I'm assuming you're quoting accurately, Elaine Belder's letter, because I haven't got it in my mind, but you mentioned in that dividends are restricted to 30% of profits unless there's unanimous agreement to have higher dividends. I think it's worth noting that in the year just gone by, dividends, I think, were about 130% of profits. That came about due to the agreement which we reached on funding with Alcoa. This was reached by John and his people. And it was done, as I said earlier, by their persuasive engagement with Alcoa to ensure that an appropriate outcome was reached. I think that I'm satisfied, and I know my colleagues are satisfied, that we get very good service out of our management. I'd go back to what I said earlier. This is a $20 billion enterprise. We as shareholders, that is Illumina, own 40% of that. Where you've got a company which is the manager and the principal owner, that's the 60% owner, I would say it requires the minority partner to be extra vigilant to ensure that the majority partner does not in fact use its position to diminish the returns to the minority. And that is, in our view, is what our management has done very effectively over many years. And we're satisfied that the structure which we've got in place should continue into the future. And as I said earlier, John Marley performed that role admirably, and we as a board have got great confidence that John Bevan will lead that forward in a like manner.
Thanks, John. I was going to commiserate with Mr. Pizzi's $500 million against vote and simply say, don't worry, mine will be a lot higher than that, John. I've been, banging my head against the brick wall with Illumina for the last 5 years. In 2003, I came along and basically made the same points you've already heard earlier today, that we are a special company, we only have a handful of employees, we don't do much, we don't have control over much, and therefore we don't need to have five non-executive directors, a CEO, a finance director, a company secretary / general counsel. And also I made the point that our directors were paid too much. And that was back in 2003 when the chairman was on $212,000 a year and the individual non-executive directors were on $85,000 a year. I've been making the point successively and I've been continually being ignored by the board. And this year, or last year, the chairman was on $316,000 a year. He's had a pay rise increase of 50% over that period. And the non-executive directors are now on $132,000. They've had a pay rise increase of 54% over that period. same time, the share price has only gone up 20 to 25%, although there's been a nice dividend flow that's come from there. In terms of the size of the board, I mean, I was at the Iris Market Technology AGM yesterday. They have four non-executive directors, and they're now down to three. Last week, I was in Perth at the WA News annual meeting. They have four non-executive directors. So the fact that we only have probably 10 employees, and we actually have a bigger board than many other companies, I think just demonstrates the point that we are being massively over-serviced for what we require to basically administer our postbox company and negotiate with Alcoa from time to time. So I basically have become exasperated and decided that the only way to really crank up the pressure to get the board to acknowledge some of these points was to stand for election and put the issues out there that way. Now, I appreciate that I'll have Buckley's chance of getting elected, but I would think it would serve a very good purpose to send a message from the floor today that you'd like some action taken on some of these issues. And I'll get clobbered in the proxies, but we can send a message in the show of hands. Now, in terms of the other point about this board, I think the world changed on November 25 last year when John Howard was voted out of office. I mean, John Howard was one of the great climate change deniers, and our company was very much associated with the lobbying around that climate change denial. We were founding members of the Australian Industry Greenhouse Network. We've been mentioned adversely in books by the likes of Clive Hamilton and Guy Pearce. None of our directors were invited to the 2020 summit. John Marley, straight after the election, decided he was out of here. I mean, I think it's probably a good move, given he was so associated with the whole Howard, do nothing, deny, delay approach, by which he might have got out of there in a flash as well. So I think he's done the right thing in leaving. But I think this board needs to therefore refresh its personnel to get with the program and to appreciate that we now have the Garneau report coming and we actually have to be inside the tent. We are now completely outside the tent. I mean, I had a catch-up last year with a senior Brumby government advisor who was speaking very critically about the fact that this company have been climate change deniers, that they've taken huge subsidies from cheap power, and they go into negotiations with this board and they see the former finance director of WMC as the chairman, they see the former Alcoa guy there, they don't see any personnel change. So I think the board does need to be refreshed to reflect the fact that carbon taxes, carbon trading systems are coming, and we need to negotiate and get the best deal we possibly can. And that's where I think I could add some value. As a former press secretary in the Kennett government, as someone who works with media and journalists and politics, I've met Penny Wong, I've met Peter Garrett, I've met John Brumby. I'm actually connected, not in a close way, but I have had dealings with these people that they would talk to me, that I've come across them before, and I actually think that they would see someone who accepts climate change is here and accepts that the whole denial period is gone would add some value to this board. And it would be a sign that we do appreciate there's a new environment. This current board, average age 64, very long service. And for mine, one of the great tragedies of Australia is the fact that so much of our resources dowry has been mismanaged. You know, you can cite the companies, the likes of Rio, Shell, BP, Chevron, Anglo American, Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Xstrata. They all own well over $10 billion worth of Australian resource assets. There are so few Australian resource companies left. Too often you have this situation. We're just a little minority shareholder. We don't control it. Big American company actually runs the business. Same with Bass Strait, which is run by Exxon. And too many of our directors have been associated, in my view, with that mismanagement of our resources dowry. And I don't want to speak ill of Mark Rayner, but I was in this room 8 years ago at the last Pasminco AGM. Pasminco blew up, a couple of $1 billion, went broke. And I thought to myself, that's the end of Mark's career as a non-executive chairman of a company, because it was major destruction of value. But here we are 8 years later, and he's finally retiring. And I think the message here is that we haven't refreshed our directors' club. Our directors generally have mismanaged Australia's resources dowry. We haven't done well enough. We haven't turned over the talent. And this is basically an old-boy Melbourne Mining Club board. Ron McNeely, great job at Worley Parsons, but 40 years BHP. The chairman, 30 years at WMC. Mark Rayner, 30 years aluminium, Rio Tinto. Many of them, I think, their days are past. And I think we need to renew the board because of the changed political environment and because of the personnel of our board and the fact that we need a new generation of talent coming through. So I don't say I'm the best guy around. I'm primarily standing to send a message on this whole pay issue. But I think that if you do vote for me today, You will also send a message to the board about this question of board renewal, about getting with the program on climate change and sustainability, and about the excessive $12.6 million a year that we're paying to have our postbox company administered. So by voting for me, by show of hands, I can tell you you won't be risking me getting on the board because proxies will flog me, but you will be sending the board a strong message, and I invite you to do that today. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Main. Would a shareholder please move that Mr. Main be elected a director of the company? Thank you. Would a shareholder please second that motion? Thank you. The motion is now open to discussion. Does anyone wish to speak to the motion? If there are no questions, we will move to the vote. Before putting this motion to the vote, I will disclose the proxy position for this resolution. Votes where the proxies were directed to vote for the motion are 44,505,442. Votes where proxies were directed to vote against the motion are 664,227,568. Votes where the proxies may exercise discretion on how to vote are 19,316,350. And finally, the number of votes where the proxy was directed to abstain on the motion was 2,517,045. I now put the motion to the vote. All those in favour of the motion, please raise your yellow admittance card with it clearly in view. Against? That motion is carried. So we move to the next item. Sorry, what? Ladies and gentlemen, the motion was carried on a... However, based on the proxy position that I have disclosed, I have reason to believe that the view of the meeting expressed on a poll is likely to be different, and I therefore direct that the matter be considered on a poll. To avoid delaying shareholders longer than need be, the poll on this motion will be conducted after the conclusion of other business. I will now stand the motion over and proceed to the next item of business on the agenda, which is item 4 of your notice of meeting.